Okay, if you'll bear with me, I think we'll begin, even though some people will be coming in. I have some announcements I think I can make while people are getting settled. Some of you are asking about the materials on display in the foyer on the table. We asked John Ruth to bring some things along for display, and then the church library here has some of his books, and some of the rest of us brought a few things, mainly for exhibit for this evening, and they'll be there after the program, and then probably we'll take them up. They won't be there during the church service here tomorrow morning, but tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 we'll have a meeting, and before then we'll display them again. And then following that, some of those items, John says, are for sale. If there are multiple copies tonight, we would part with them, of course. But if there's only a single copy, we'd rather not sell until after they've been exhibited tomorrow. So at the end of the program. And anything printed is $16. The frock tours, and John Ruth may need to tell you more what frock tours are. But his wife, Roma, does that work freehand. Someone asked me, how does she do that? Is it with a computer or something? No, it's freehand. She's an artist. Some of you know Roma, his wife. And anything that's on tape, the videos and so forth out there, they're $20. And he brought some along, and he would sell those too. Before turning the meeting over to John, introducing him, I'm going to have Larry Eby come up, and I think now all of you have one of these per family. And on this Zion Church property, the Oregon Mennonite Historical and Genealogical Society has made plans to construct a building, the Archives Library, to replace the existing one that we have at Western Mennonite School. Larry Eby has been very happy, very helpful as a consultant to our board in kind of planning for raising the funds and putting together some information that you now have in your hands. And we've asked Larry to explain that today before the presentation this evening. And we'll not take any questions, or we won't comment further on that this evening, but we will after the presentation tomorrow at the spring meeting of the OMHGS, we'll take time for a business meeting, and part of that, we'll come back to this paper and give you more detail, and you'll have an opportunity, if you have questions, to ask them then. Larry?
I'm not really used to speaking from behind the pulpit, or this is not my usual place of work, but I am here this evening to remind us that the work of the events, the important things that happened with OMHGS are eating together like we have tonight and having speakers such as John Ruth and many others come and teach us things about our past and about the importance of things. But one of the really important things about this society is that we are the curators and keepers of the artifacts, including many written things and other things, of the past of Mennonites in Oregon and in the Northwest. And there's a project that is planned that you're going to be hearing more about, and that is described in the paper that you got tonight, and the picture, the artist's illustration of what this new facility might look like. When you go to people and you ask them for things, I remember growing up and saying, can you make a case for it? And I learned in the recent years really what making a case is, and my work with Drift Creek Camp, where I did some fundraising, and also with the Mennonite Village, where I did some fundraising, that in order for people to be interested and supporting a project, either materially or by helping to build it or whatever, you have to make a case for why it's important. And so we have here this two-page document, and I'm not going to tell you what's in it. You can read it just as well as I. There's one mistake of a word, which really doesn't matter if you don't find it, because it doesn't make any difference in terms of the story. So I'm not going to tell you which word it is, except it's in the very last paragraph. And it's the second word of the very last paragraph, so you can look for it. But had I not told you, I'll bet three-fourths of you wouldn't have found it, because even our proofreaders didn't find it the first several times through. So read this, and I want to say enjoy, but maybe it's not that kind of literature. At least learn and be reminded of the importance of this organization and of having adequate facilities in which to keep the treasures that this organization has.
Thank you, Larry. I mentioned before the evening meal, we're living in history too. We are a part of history. By meeting here at the Zion congregation, our church, and I think all of you are familiar with Hope Lynn's book that came out, I believe, in 1990, Apart and Together, the history of the Mennonites in Oregon and surrounding neighboring states. And I'd just like to use a quote from that I found interesting, having to do with the Zion congregation, which, by the way, celebrated their centennial in 1993. Margaret Shetler, is that correct? Where is Margaret? Yes. And the featured guest speaker at that event was John Landis Ruth. So he is coming back, 14 years later, I guess. Zion was a young congregation, Hopeland writes, in frontier country, and new settlers missed their well-established home congregation. One young mother wrote back to Missouri to a relative that on Sunday she always thought of the Sycamore Grove Church and the Sunday school there that she left as a young person. She saw quite a difference between it and Zion and didn't blame the few young folks from Missouri if they didn't like Oregon. She continued, "I tell you, I'm glad I got a man before I came to Oregon. For I think surely I should have been an old maid if I had to pick one up here." Ha ha, she says. Well, we still have young people, both male and female, though, leaving Oregon to find their spouses at places like Heston, Goshen, and MCC, and so on, don't we? In another letter, she lamented the wild place compared to old Cass County, with so many infidels, unbelievers, hard-hearted people, rough, who hunt just as much on Sunday as any other day of the week. She thought some who did profess Christianity were awful slack. Never no evangelizing preachers come here. Sometimes she yearned to hear a good old-fashioned waking-up sermon. Zion preachers did preach the word as well as they could, she supposed, but she thought Oregon was awful dull. And she goes on to write that the first people met in the home, I believe, of John Lais at that time. I've known of John Ruth for many years, and like you, have read some of his works, but never really did meet him until I had the privilege in 2004. To go with Tour Imagination on a tour, it's called Swiss Millennium Tour, to 11 countries in Europe. And we ended up in the Ukraine. We started in Frankfurt, I guess it was, yeah. And John and his wife, Roma, were leaders of the tour along with Jim Yonke. And it was really a fantastic tour. John is a noted Mennonite author and historian. He completed his PhD work at Harvard University in 1968. And I've told a lot of people this, John, and I don't know if I've ever checked it out with you because I got it secondhand. But I am told that when you went up to the platform to receive your doctor's degree at Harvard, You were the first Mennonite in a plain coat, garbed in a plain coat, to do so. As far as you know, is that correct?
I'm going to have to say that I don't think any of the facts there are factual.
Oh, okay. So he'll straighten this up. Okay. Well, it wasn't in 1968. Okay. And you were ordained as a minister before that, though?
18 years before.
18 years before. Okay, well, thank you for the correction. I'm still glad I said it.
I collect those things.
Okay. After that, he taught for a while at Eastern College in Philadelphia and also at the University of Hamburg in Germany. And in 72, he became an associate minister at his home congregation, which is Salford Mennonite Church. And among the books he has written are The Earth is the Lord's, Maintaining the Right Fellowship. They're both on display out there on the table. And Conrad Grebel, Son of Zurich, which I didn't see out there, which I have read. He comes to us from Harleysville, Pennsylvania. And he and his wife, Roma, live on land. Now, maybe this is another story that he can say is false. And I think he told me some of this, so I think it's right. Lives on the very land that has been in the Ruth family since 1718. And where his grandchildren and are the 10th generation now residents on that land. They have several children and nine or more grandchildren. One of John's lifelong hobbies has been photography, and he did a lot of work with slide photography, and that evolved into videos and now into digital photography. And he's going to use that in presenting kind of a composite of 40 years of going back and forth to Europe, and he's led many tours. I think he said maybe 30 or 40 tours during that time period. And so we're going to get an overview or a contemporary tour of Anabaptist-related sites in Europe. It's a pleasure to have you here, John.
Thank you. Am I on?
Yep.
Thank you. I'm going to turn on the projector here. And until it actually appears on the screen, we'll be in a slight state of suspense, but we had it working wonderfully earlier, and so as soon as that warms up, I think we should see something come up. I did start taking photographs in Europe in 1975 with a new camera. There it seems to be coming, doesn't it? Projector. Yeah, we've got it. Right, yeah. And let's see if that should get brighter as we go along. I think it is. Yeah, those front lights should all go off. And that's right. I'm simply going to do the... Oops. Let's see what happened there. Oh, my laptop is giving out false information here. It'll come back. Right. There we go. And what, when you don't do anything with this for a while, it goes to sleep on you. Let's see. I should, something moved here a little bit. Yeah. I should go over there just a bit, I believe. Okay. I promised to give a kind of a user-friendly review of sites, S-I-T-E-S, in Europe that an Anabaptist-related person would have special interest in. Now, tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to speak with slides again on the how the Anabaptist movement emerged in Europe in the 1520s and in the next century or so. And I'll try to develop the logic of why it did. Two pictures. This here is a travelogue tonight. This is a travelogue, bit of a fun thing, okay? Let's see what happens when we call on the European tour for Oregon. There we go. Let's go to a slideshow. And then let's go, right there. Just a minute, stop right there. Now, there we're on the 747, right? And I'm cheating a little bit. That's on the way home, but it'll be on the way there for us. See the sign for Lufthansa up there in the top? Do you know what Lufthansa means? You know what Luft is in German? Hansa is the Hanseatic League of the cities there along the Baltic. And that's what it means. Now, I'll tell you, did you ever hear Willow Valley in Lancaster County? Anybody? John Thomas, the super mega restaurateur who could really run everything. Well, when my friend Harold Fly, anybody remember him? Took John Thomas through South America. John Thomas, who was a multi-millionaire, could not get the hang of saying Lufthansa. As a restaurateur, it always came out lasagna. But they got there. By the way, I think it'd be nice if that door were closed there, because then you won't have that in the corner of your eye. Yeah, that is. That is my wife right in the front there looking at me. She's very long-suffering with a camera. She knows that I won't quit until... All right. Now, the only reason I have this here is not to advertise that book. But that is a picture of me in about 1973, taken by Jan Gleichstein. And it came out in this book that I had no idea there was such a book until they handed me a copy. But I'm standing along the Neckar River in about 1973 in south of Tübingen in the town of Rottenburg, where the wife of Michael Sattler was drowned. And I'm reading out of the Martyr's Mirror. Now, before we go on too long, there I'm young. I'll show you what I look like reading out of the Martyr's Mirror today. Okay. Again, this isn't what I'm hoping there won't be that many of me from here on in, but there are here at the beginning. That's in Dutch. Can you read it? In my father's house are viele woningen, are many mansions. How do you like that symbol on the grave there? Time flies, right? Okay. That's in the Netherlands. Now we're on the Rhine River. And I think, yeah, you were on this tour, I believe, Ray. And we're heading upstream, and we're all dead tired because the first day when you're over there, you've been flying all night across the Atlantic, but you have to do something the first day. You've got to get your money's worth. So we got on the boat there. I told my boss that it was not a good idea, but it didn't do any good. Here is a huge barge pushing another huge barge upstream along the Rhine. It flows at 14 miles an hour. So you have to overcome that and then go some more yet, okay? We are going through the Lorelei. You know what I mean? At the top, in mythical, in German myth, sat the Lorelei, combing her golden hair and distracting the sailors who then crashed on the rocks. And when you, right at this moment, we're going right through the Lorelei. This is last summer, I believe. And we're going upstream. And then they always play a snatch from that song. Ich weiß nicht, was soll das bedeuten, dass ich so traurig bin, and so forth. And I think I might have a snatch of music. What happened was somebody had a birthday in our tour. And here there was a guy with an accordion, and a woman is flouncing around, dancing to it, and she had a big gold comb. And she put it right in the top of the head of one of our travelers who had a birthday. And I hope this will happen now. Watch. No, it didn't, but it will. Just a minute here. I'm going back and catch that. Let's see. How can I find that? There. The barrel now. Okay, now we're way back in the 1400s. Who's that? Pied Piper. Oh, no, 1284. That's the legend in Hameln. And I think I might have another take of that. Next, please. Let's see. No, I don't want that. I want this. There's another representation of the Pied Piper, and there are people following him all the way across the top of an arch that you don't see on this picture, okay? Northern Germany. This is Roland. Ever hear of Roland, the Song of Roland, which is a great metrical romance of the Middle Ages? In Northern Germany are frequent statues of Roland, which celebrates the independence of the various cities that have them. This happens to be in Bremen. You remember Bremen more, perhaps. Well, here's another statue of a forester going out with his thumb on the point on his axe to make sure it's ready for chopping that day. There's, you remember Bremen, the town musicians of Bremen? There, that's a... They scared the robbers away, I believe, in the story that was put together by the Brothers Grimm. Germany, of course, is a land of castles. And this is one that you see between Koblenz and Bupard on the Rhine, on the eastern or northern banks. And today it's turned into a hotel. And you can go in. They have a. This was a medieval castle. See, the Rhine was a division of power between the Germans on the north and the French in the south, and that was the battle line. And so it was ringed with castles. And this particular castle has a fireplace in it, big enough to roast an ox in. In the cathedrals of the Middle Ages, you find the whole Bible story repeatedly told, and this is the main tympanum over the main entrance to the Strasbourg Cathedral, which was almost burnt down in the French Revolution and kept, I don't have time to go into that, but there'll be another one. Jan Hus is memorialized in the center of Prague. He was a pre-Protestant reformer, burned at the stake about 100 years before Martin Luther, along Lake Constance. And he was said to have said, see, Hus means in Czech, it means goose. He said, today you are roasting a goose, but in 100 years will come a white swan, and he will preach the gospel. And Luther then was often depicted with the logo of a swan. In the Middle Ages, that there was rivalry between the merchants and the bishops of the church and the commerce, and they couldn't agree on which side of the river in Bamberg to put the town hall, and so they put it in the middle of the river, and neither one had the advantage. That's in Bavaria. You would never in this world guess where that is. That is in a church in Switzerland, and it is in the very building where we believe that Jacob Ammann, the founder of the Amish church, was baptized as a boy. His father later joined the Anabaptists, and he did too. But that is the symbol of St. Mark. And there are four of these in the dome above the apse of this particular church, and each one has represents one of the four Gospels. Once again, you see the biblical story represented. This happens to be in Freiburg, in Baden-Württemberg, and down towards Switzerland. That's the entrance to the cathedral in Freiburg. This is a fascinating Renaissance a bit of statuary in the town of Würzburg. And you would never believe what's going on here, but I'm going to explain it to you. Do you see the figure up ahead that seems to have, up on top, that seems to have a pipeline going down? And you see it goes to this feminine figure over here to the right? That's an angel over there, right? That to this pipeline goes in the ear of that feminine woman, of that woman. That's Mary. And that's how the artist depicted fact that she was inspired by the Holy Spirit to have this son, this pipe going down. This is in Strasbourg. Again, it's the three wise men. And the thing that I find particularly intriguing about this picture is one of the wise men is African, there on the left. You would see that clearer if we were closer. He's clearly from Africa with his hair and his facial contours. This is, 1968 or 9, I took this, where a Mennonite minister is pointing out this bishop's warehouses, the Bischof's Hofhaltung in Bamberg, in Bavaria. The bishop was also a prince, and he needed all this. It goes the whole way around the Hof like that, and we can only see one section of the Hof. That's where he stored the tribute brought in by the peasants around the town, because he was the prince and the bishop. This you see all over Europe. This happens to be in Münster. It is Saint, carrying Jesus across the water and with a rod, Saint Christopher. Christopher means Christ bearer. And there's this legend that he took Jesus across, safely across a creek or a river or something. This is one of my favorite paintings of all time. It's in the Alsatian town of Colmar, and it is part of the most magnificent triptych. It's a triptych of triptychs that I have ever seen. The more famous part of the triptych is Jesus on the cross, which I don't have here, but then you also see him rising from the dead. A Jewish man told me that he was converted by this picture. Around 1500, 1495, something like that. And it's amazing that it's like an atomic fireball behind him. And you see Jesus rising. The rock is floating. The soldiers are falling. They obey the law of gravity. But Jesus rising in triumph from the dead with a victory symbol. Every time I get close to there with a group, I try to take it in there, and I can tell you something. Some people go through there like a knife through butter, and then wonder what we went in there for, and other people stand there transfixed. This is in Bad Friedrichshall. No. Well, I'm sorry. It's not in that town. It's in another one whose name I forget every time. But anyway, this is the cathedral. It's the town where Melchior Hoffman comes from, and I can't even. Schwäbisch Hall, and it's the angel, my archangel, fighting with the dragon. A European town. The difference between a town and a village is that a town has walls and a city has walls, and particularly when it gets the Staatsrecht, it gets the states. The right from the emperor to have its own taxes and laws, then it puts a wall around it. And this is a model of a town that actually still has the wall. As you see, you can walk. It takes you about a half an hour, three quarters of an hour to walk all around the town on that wall. That is a town called Nördlingen in Bavaria. And in that tower, the most interesting, there's an actual a watchman lives in that tower. This is a scene that Conrad Grebel's father would have seen. I shouldn't have taken this picture, it's forbidden, but that is a statue of Mary and her baby Jesus in a chapel inside a cathedral in Einsiedeln, in the canton of Schwyz in Switzerland. And every so often they change the dress on her and the baby. She is known as the Black Madonna of Einsiedeln. And the reason she is totally black and the baby totally black is there have been so many candles burned there over the centuries that the smoke has turned them black. Now, there are a number of black Madonnas in Europe, all for the same reason. I try to take my group here every time we get to Switzerland because the monks in the afternoon will come and have their vespers. And then they'll all come, these Benedictine monks, they'll all come and stand where these people are kneeling. They'll fill that chapel and they'll sing a song of praise to Mary. And it's very haunting to listen. This is the castle of the Wartburg where a friendly noble kidnapped, in quotes, Martin Luther to save him from the Pope and the Emperor and hid him here. And in this castle, Martin Luther translated the New Testament. That's in Thuringia. The reason I dip my hand in here every year is that's about the exact spot where Conrad Grebel baptized George Blaurock. I don't think the house is there anymore, but it was right there on that street, and it's only a few feet away from where it had to happen. And the water that I think they took would have been piped up there from the Limmat River in Zurich, as it still is, as you can see here. So I always put my hand in there. There, that was just last summer. He isn't about to be baptized, although he could use it, I think, that particular man. There's Ray. You see yourself, Ray? That's 2004. And the thing that we're there for is that plaque on the left-hand side of the picture, which in that year, just a few months before we were there, finally was put there to commemorate the execution by drowning and beheading of Felix Manz in 1527 and Hans Landis in 1614, the first and the last of the martyrs, the Anabaptist martyrs. In Zurich. In 1527, likewise, Michael Sattler and his wife were executed under Catholic authority. Zurich was Protestant. See, it says there, sie starben für ihren Glauben. They died for their faith, Michael and Margaret Sattler. He was a Cistercian monk who joined the Anabaptists and wrote the Schleitheim Confession. Here's a town in Austria along the Inn River, which the other summer had a Schlossbergspiele, the castle drama. Up above, to the left, there's a hill, and up there, there's an open-air theater, and they put on a play called The Hutterites, which really amazed us, because I think that was the same year that you were along, Ray, that we saw that here. And there we are, standing with a later time, I guess, up on top of that hill, of that town where Pilgrim Marpeck lived and was the head of the mining industry in those mountains. That's the Inn River flowing toward us there, which joins the Danube at Passau in Bavaria. Anybody tell me where we are here? We're in the Netherlands. That's Pingham. That tower that stands there in the middle is the same tower to this day. The rest of the church has been changed, but not the tower, where Menno Simons got his start as a priest, as a young fellow. I told you that the Inn River joined the Danube. Well, there are three rivers coming together. At the top, it is the Inn. That's still very glacial. The color of the stone in the Alps is still coloring the Inn. Then the broader one is the Blue Danube. And the little one here coming from the bottom is the Ilz. And where they came together is this castle. Now, in 1500 and about 35, eventually a total of 60 Anabaptists were caught trying to get home from what we would call the Czech Republic, Moravia, Bohemia. They wanted to get into their home near here, and they were caught and they put in this castle. And that is where the Ausbund was born. You know the Amish hymn book? Some of those hymns that they composed in that castle are still in the Ausbund and are still sung today. There, one year, years ago, I have an Ausbund in my hand. We're down in the dungeon and we're talking about that. The Amish call the Ausbund the Dickbuch and the Mennonite Gesangbuch the Dinbuch. Now, on the left is an old Ausbund from 1785 from Philadelphia. And then in the middle is an Ausbund that the way they use it now. The next is the 1804 Mennonite Lancaster hymn book, the Gesangbuch. And on the right is the present day version. They print them by the thousands, year after year after year, the Amish and the Old Order Mennonites, who are in North America the fastest growing body of Mennonites in the 21st century. And they sing from them all the time. This is the so-called Mennolinde. When we were there in 1968, I took that picture. It's legendary-wise, it's supposed to have been planted by Menno Simons at the last place he lived, near Lübeck, near the Baltic, and where his books were printed in the so-called Menno Kata. That sign is actually it's a sign for a revival meeting of some sort. Gospel, I can't quite read it from here. See what it says. Gospel. Oh, Gospel Unlimited. Tent. A tent meeting, Gospel Unlimited, 15th of May. 1st of May, 3 o'clock. Anyway, that is the tower in which Dirk Willems was incarcerated about halfway up the tower there. And either before or after he ran for it, remember, and broke through the ice. That's in Aspern in the Netherlands. This, I don't know who made this, but I snapped a picture somewhere, but that's a modern version of the story, of the drawing by Laukens, man who etched the original, some 90 or 100 copper etchings for the original Martyr's Mirror. You all know that story, I think. It's maybe the most well-known Mennonite icon. And I'll tell you something interesting. When you go there and you talk to the people in that town, they call Dirk Willems a hero, but they have no idea he was an Anabaptist. They think he was Reformed. And they're not interested in having you correct their opinion. John Sharp has estimated that this is about the spot where they burnt Dirk Willems at the stake. There I am a few years ago. And there I am reading the Dirk Willems story on another occasion, maybe just last summer, from the Martyr's Mirror. And there's a street named for Dirk Willems in the town of Aspern, south of Amsterdam. I don't know where I saw this either, but I thought it was interesting. Any Mennonite child growing up in a Mennonite home who has not been told that story has not really been spiritually treated fairly. You've got to hear that story. There I am. Jan Gleistein shot a picture of me at the Mennolinde, 69, I guess. Behind the Menno cottage is this bronze plaque for Menno, and believe it or not, it was put there by students, university students, in appreciation for MCC's help. They had nothing to eat after World War II, and they wanted to do something to thank the Mennonites, and they put up this plaque. It tells about Menno, his life, and that he lived there and so forth. There is no contemporary picture of Menno. Only decades after he died did somebody start putting up imaginary portraits. This is the little town of Pingham, and there is the tower of the church where Menno served as a young priest. And I'm standing in that picture right in front of the hidden church of Pingham, a Mennonite church from the 1600s, which has a house and apartment in the front. And you walk in through it, and there's a hidden church in the back. Some of you, I'm sure, have been with me there. This is a huge jump. That is the Weichsel, or the Vistula River, flowing toward Gdansk, toward the Baltic, just south of Gdansk. And I took it to simply... You see, the Dutch Mennonites went there and drained that landscape and made it arable and made it actually a Lancaster County of agriculture. Of course, they all had to get out, you know, after World War II. A lot had already gone down starting in 1786 to Ukraine. This is just a quick shot of... you remember the golden roof in Vienna, in Innsbruck, Austria? Well, there it is up there. I just got an angle in the... We happen to see a group there playing. Tourism is everything there in Innsbruck. And by the way, that was put there by Maximilian I, an emperor, from whom Conrad Grebel, that is our Conrad Grebel, got a scholarship to study at the University of Vienna. But you can almost... Okay, look in the bottom left-hand corner. You see that slight little brown rectangle sticking up there? You see, can you see what I'm referring to? Well, that plaque is for Jacob Hutter, the founder of the Hutterites, who was burned at the stake here in this square. Now, what happened? Oh, I did the wrong thing. Whoops. No. Let's see if I... that's odd. I don't... Oh, there we go. Let's see if I missed anything. No, I didn't. Okay. Did you ever see this painting? Well, where is it? What is going on here? I'll try again. There we go. Okay. You ever see that painting? Yeah, Jakob von Reisdale. He used to be called a Mennonite. Actually, he wasn't. That is from the so-called golden age of Dutch art in the 1630s or 40s, the age that produced people like Vermeer, Rembrandt, and others. Unlike Italian Renaissance painting that was brilliant and almost multicolored and hypercolored, the Dutch were masters of understatement. In other words, as far as Renaissance painting, they'd been there, done that. They wanted to do something different. And it has become some of the most prized painting of the European tradition. But we want to go beyond him. This is a painting by a young fellow named Rembrandt from the Rhine. It's a picture of Jeremiah weeping over the destruction of Jerusalem. And you can see in his posture and in his expression the narrative of the story. That was Rembrandt, who himself was not a Mennonite, but married a girl from a Mennonite home. This is about 5, 6, 7 years ago, 8. And it's a statue in Friesland of Rembrandt painting a picture of his girlfriend, Saskia, who came from a Mennonite home from this village. And he got married in this village, this young fellow. And here's a picture of Saskia, whom he married, and she died young, unfortunately. Saskia von Eilenberg. Now we're jumping clean down into Switzerland, where a lot of your background is. You see the Yoder Tafel over there on the left for Joost Yoder? Matthew Zuck, Peter Blank. And this is all in Steffisburg, if you've ever been there, or will go there. I expect to take a group there this summer again. And there, those are the symbols of those clans in Switzerland, in the Reformed Church there. This is also, you hear them, people talk about the Anabaptist cave. The Anabaptist cave, There's four or five of them. And this is one that most people don't go to. It's much like the one they do go to up in Zurich. This is in Bern. And it's not far from the little town of Schongau in the Emmental, right where the Emma River starts. It's got the same kind of flue right above it, made up of stones that were once at the bottom of some lake, and the earth rolled them up again. And right in the front, it drops off, just like the one in Zurich. And it's protected on both sides. Anabaptists from Bern came here to worship when in the days of persecution. This is the so-called Täuferversteck, or hiding Anabaptist hiding place, in a town near the town of Trub, and in the Emmental. And now a young woman, a young mother, who was converted in the past 10 years or so, has taken it as her life's mission to kind of guard this and to have people come there and have a spiritual experience. This is in a barn, and the roof. I mean, there's a lid that'll come right over that within seconds, and you just disappear. They say we were hunting, we're chasing Mr. Funkhaus into the barn, and just like that, he disappeared. Well, it's under here. And do you ever hear of Leroy? Can't think of his name, from Millersburg, Ohio. He's a sign painter. And anyhow, he constructed a little model of how this thing works to show people. This is in the Netherlands. There were two main churches in Amsterdam, the Church of the Sun and the Church of the Lamb. And those are their symbols. This is the Shakespeare of the Netherlands, the greatest writer that they from the classic Netherlands period. His name was Vondel, and he was a Mennonite. When he got older, joined, I think, the Catholics again. But even before that, while he was a Mennonite deacon, he wrote what is considered to be some of the Netherlands' best literature. That is in a window in the Rijksmuseum, the Imperial Museum of Art in Amsterdam. We're jumping all over the map. I don't see Ray on there, but he was on this trip. This is on the top of a tower, south of Heidelberg. And that's a kind of a compass, a bronze compass, with lines pointing out in every direction toward indicating the location of villages or cities. This is at the epicenter of the settlements of Swiss Mennonite refugees who came north from Switzerland right after the 30 Years' War, around 1650. And whether your name would be Lichty or Kreider or Herr or Ruth or Landis or Brubaker or Eshelman or you name it, any of those names, this is where they were when they migrated to Pennsylvania. If you have any Burkholders out here, or know any, this is close to the brook, right where the Burkholders come from in Rüxau, in the Emmental in Switzerland. It's in the window of a chapel there. Family coat of arms. This man isn't living anymore, but he carved that plate. And what it is, can you see the line of pilgrims walking, carrying their bags and stuff and with their animals, walking up out of Switzerland when the persecution got so hard that they could just flee with what they had on their backs, the Stauffers and others. And he has carved on that names of people and then also places to which they went from the Palatinate at the Ebersheimer Hof. Today it's just called Ebersheim. And there I see Illinois from here. I see, what else do I see here? I can see Russia, Kansas, Illinois, Indiana. Okay, you've got good eyes. Alberta, Saskatchewan. I don't see Oregon. Sorry. The people of the Palatinate have told me, different ones, We get our agriculture from the Anabaptists who came up from Switzerland. And they turned the Palatinate into a breadbasket. See, it was ruined by the 30 Years' War. And it was ruined again in 1689 by the French, who were so angry they couldn't pull off a deal that they tried to trash the Palatinate. And anyhow, here's just one shot out of many. This is the Emmental. Yoders, Stauffers, Eschelmans. What do you have out here? Kaufman, yes. Eby, yes. Well, yeah, a little west of here. Uh-huh. Sure. Why did they ever leave? They were not romantics. Mountains to them were something to get over, not something you could come and get up in a hotel at the top of it and drink coffee and look out over it. Like we. The remote, more remote, the more likely you were likely to find Anabaptists in there. There you see a couple of farms at the upper end of the Emmental. A man who took me through there told me there was a report that the Reformed preacher said that preaching to these people out here was, in German, I forget the word he used in German, was just umsonst, in vain. There are the Alps, and there are the foothills of the Alps. That's called the Oberland, the upper land. That's where the Amish come from. The most conservative part of the most conservative canton in Switzerland. That's Amish. Do you remember when they had the split in 1693, Ammon resented Bishop Hans Reist? Do you remember? Anybody remember that? Hans Reist was the man he opposed. I went with an old man who could talk Swiss language, and we hunted and hunted, and they told him up that that's his house. That was at the time that he and Ammon had their difference. It's way up and hangs on the side of a hill. That's the valley called the Simmental. And in that narrow valley lived Jacob Ammon. They don't come any more conservative than that in Switzerland. Ever hear of Simmental cattle? That's where that comes from. Jumping to clean to the top of Europe, there's a man, I think he's still living. His name is Heinold Fast. And he was the premier German Mennonite historian until he retired. But notice the fancy pulpit from which he preached in Norden, where the Mennonites were wealthy on the whaling and the shipping trade. And it was an entirely different story from the Swiss Mennonites, who were plain. Here I am. You know any culps? Can you see Tilman Culp carved in the top there? 1699. That is in the Palatinate in Wolfsheim. That's where all the culps come from, the Mennonite culps. Well, this is a tourist-friendly thing here. It's the Rheinfall at Schaffhausen in the border between Switzerland and Germany. And it's just like a mini Niagara Falls. Instead of the Maid of the Mist, you get on that little boat. Now, this is the Aare River, A-A-R-E. It's at Bern. Bern is like a banana that sticks out, and the Aare River flows right around the tip of the banana. And here I am, just past the tip, and I'm standing at the spot where they loaded Anabaptists on boats to ship them out of Switzerland. There's a little boat there. And right behind me, they have a big drawing on the wall. And I think there it is. Now I'm pointing to that arch where they would put the people that they were kicking out of Bern in 1710 and 1711. 1710, one boatload, and 1711, I think, four boatloads. Oh, there we skip that. Now we're on the Rhine again. And that's the so-called Pfalzgraf. That's, would you believe, a wealthy man built a castle in the middle of the Rhine, stretched a chain across, and wouldn't let you pass unless you paid him something. You know what they do today? People get domain names on the internet, and you have to pay them to have it because they thought of it first. Same principle. A fellow in our community was accused. He said, look, I'm in business. So I take this picture, which is hanging in the entrance to the Single Mennonite Church in Amsterdam, to show you that Mennonites of the Netherlands became wealthy and cultured within 100 years of the end of persecution. This is a Swiss Mennonite family. Dutch Mennonite family. Now that looks Dutch, doesn't it? That house there on the left. And it is Dutch. But it is in Poland. It's in Elbing. And it's a Mennonite church of the Prussian Mennonites on the left. Today it's an art museum. But today they call it Elblag. They took their their culture along with them to Prussia. You might know where that is, do you? Kortice, yes, near Zaporozhye in Ukraine. That's how it used to look, that great oak. Long before there were any Mennonites to come there, the Cossacks would have their rendezvous under that. And later the Mennonites did. It's still there, but almost dead. There I am with a Cossack horse, but there's the tree. And you can see maybe there's a greenery at the top. One branch has life in it yet.